Okay, and welcome back. Our second hour coming up now with Clifford Carnicom, talking about Morgellons, the affliction, the disorder, the syndrome, which quite clearly has identifiable components now in 100% of the people that Clifford has worked with. This is an issue that may well be spread around the planet now. We don't know. The government is quite clearly obfuscating the issue as well. All right, Clifford, let's go right ahead.
Yes, and unfortunately, you know, we have to put on par with our discussion of Morgellons all of the historical work and research done by the countless people across the world for the last 8 to 9, 10 years on aerosols or chemtrail issue. Because of the connections that we're seeing, we must now consider that as a composite investigation. Before I discuss this paper on the observation of the sample from a child, I want to take a slight little detour, if I can, and it's simply to show the historical context of how sort of research unfolds and the links that are made, sometimes not knowing until years later how certain connections will take place. But if we look back at my work, there was a paper that I wrote in December of 2003, and that paper was called An Unusual Medical Finding. And that paper involved where I started to develop a tooth problem somewhat unexpectedly and quickly.
Which tooth? Describe it, like an impacted tooth, an infected tooth, just a sore tooth, what?
Sore tooth. I got a lot of pain up in the gum.
No other
and
symptoms.
That's going to end up being real important in our discussion tonight as we go along. But
right.
You know, 5 years ago, I had a very unusual, let's say, set of circumstances take place. We can talk about that one all night. But it involved a laser light. Also, it involved demonstration of motility or movement of some type of form unknown at that time. Something that would move around within the mouth, a response to light, and basically appear to seek refuge. And that continues on and gets a little bit more complicated if we had time to talk about it. But at that time, in December of 2003, I did write this paper. And what happened was, in that painful area of the tooth, I extracted a small sample. I put it under the scope with the equipment I had at that time and presented it and said, this is what I see. And what did I see at that time? I saw a fibrous network appearing and had no idea how that might link in at some point. That was, if we actually look at my work closely, you'll see that's the first time that I made a reference that we may have a similarity of form between other filament samples we're looking at environmentally airborne and something that's occurring in the human body. But it was so preliminary at that point, it was strictly a suggestion that maybe something is going on. Now, on my side, I knew that there was a little bit more going on that I didn't write about, and that had to do with the unusual response of this pain to laser light and the motion of it and what I would call seeking of refuge.
Mm-hmm.
So that paper was put there, and the little detour here is that, you know, I have certain detractors in my research. They don't seem to be quite as popular or successful as they were in the early years. But, you know, there's a certain body of people that have certainly attempted to ridicule or discredit my work, especially in the early years. I'll just say as a point of observation, I keep track of that a little bit because sometimes responses are helpful. And I noticed two main responses over the years, and that is one is if the information is so profound that it truly may impact, let's say, the large-scale population, I see one of two responses commonly that come from the detractor, and that is one of complete avoidance, no reaction whatsoever. In other words, don't say a single word, just do not react. And that can, let's say, diminish the publicity of an issue sometimes if there's simply no reaction. The other is one of ridicule, that of attempting to discredit a person. I've never really mentioned this before, but let's just say casually, I keep track of this over the years. And there are three areas where I have noticed this rather concerted effort to ridicule something, which from my standpoint was simply presented as another observation, right? Nothing that I'm doing is, let's say, elevated in its priority. At this point, you're gathering information. So I put up these papers. To me, they're the same as all other papers.
Yes, yes. The origin of the criticisms, you've got my interest here. I'm
curious.
Yeah,
so there's three areas where there's been sort of, to me, an unusual sort of focus and effort to try and discredit that work, and they are as follows. The first one is this article I wrote on this extraction of this tooth sample in December 2003. You know, if you look at the personal attacks that have been made, you know, and the old internet buzz and all that kind of junk that goes on, there's been a rather inordinate response to that article about, you know, Clifford Carnicom extracting this sample from his tooth and subjecting himself to pain, you know, in somewhat of, let's say, a crazed fashion. Why would such an individual ever do that, okay? So that's one, and it caught my interest at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I could add on a fourth, but that would be the immediate, when people started reporting filament, you know, San Francisco did a television news piece on it. They started to have video footage, and people were talking about the filaments for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
They really went after those people. But the second one in my case would be all that work that I did that encountered erythrocytes or desiccated what appear to be the best I can come up with, not much doubt in my mind, of desiccated red blood cells or erythrocytes in airborne samples. There was very strong efforts made to ridicule and discredit their work. And the reason I'm saying this at this time, folks, is that in the end, these end up being clues. they're clues to us.
You bet they are.
To some things that should be taken, rather importantly, if you'll get past the little hoopla that goes along out on the internet buzz.
Mm-hmm.
And just pay attention to them. And a third one, and these are all curious things. I can sit back and laugh at them in certain ways, too, because they would seem ludicrous when you first read of them. I can see why somebody might do that. But there's more to it than that under the scenes, and I know that. And the third one had to do with the use of a hair perm solution. And we're going to talk more about this later, because on the surface, it does become humorous. Why would Clifford Carnicom be using hair perm solution on something? Well, that's going to be a little bit interesting as we go along here. But that work, if you look at it, dates back literally to 1999. It's when that first EPA sample came up.
Mm-hmm.
I did some work involving the use of a hair perm, and it's going to get into the subject of protein analysis. That's where it's going to go, and we'll get there hopefully later tonight. Because there's some interesting loops that are being made through 10 years of research that you wouldn't have the slightest idea that are going to become important. So I'll just toss those out, you know, as a little sidelight for people to keep track of these kind of things and watch how connections are made over the years within recurring themes and the level of importance that they eventually might assume, whereas the initial response might be at the level, you know, of humor and or ridicule or the internet buzz that was successful in the early years, at least to some degree. On to this consideration of a child. There was a child that offered his or her blood to be looked at under the scope. And this paper is called And Now Our Children, and it was written on January 11th of 2008. We can just see, I know I can see now looking back, just a lot of things were able to be done in November through January of the turn of the year last year.
That was a very productive time.
And these pictures are actually, they're pretty darn clear as I look. This is the best I can do with my scope. I know somebody else might say it's blurry, and all, that's all true. But nevertheless, these are actually pretty remarkable photos. And what you have here is a 9-year-old child that is willing to have their blood put under the scope. I have to say, you know, it's just a very kind and generous thing, an unselfish thing of this parent as well as the child to do.
Indeed.
Because, you know, it's a heavy subject for people
sure.
to deal with.
Yeah.
And for somebody to do that, it does take an act of courage, even whether it appears to be anonymous or not. It takes an act of courage to do that, to open yourself up to examination like that. And this was really unknown. I had no idea what to expect. But the end result is that when the blood sample of this 9-year-old was looked at in the same way that it was for all of the other individuals, meaning including those that manifested visible symptoms on the outside as well as those who don't,
okay.
you see the same exact structures within the blood. Okay?
Oh, my.
And if somebody looks at these photographs, I have three. I will always try to find sort of the best case I can of that blood in terms of cellular uniformity integrity, you know, no breaching of the cell walls, that type of thing. Always try to find the best that I can in the sample, and I'll put that up, and that's what I did. And I can find that. It's not like the whole sample is necessarily degraded. And so I did that. I start with that. But then there are areas within that blood sample that show the same patterns going on. And, you know, now you have a better photograph that is showing something. You know, it's saying it looks like it's in the cell, folks, not exterior to the cell. It looks like you've got it within the cell. And this is where we can see sort of clearly for the first time that we're dealing with something that if it's inside the blood cell, if that's true, it just causes all kinds of problems with respect to our immune systems, normal testing, whether or not you would ever see such a thing. And yet this is what's showing up, is the indication that we're dealing within the blood cell.
Amazing.
Now, and this is what leads to, and I'll mention those when we get back, but this is what leads to the offering, my offering, of a candidate for investigation of chlamydia pneumonia. And there's some very specific characteristics of that organism that are worthy of mention and offer a basis for investigation.
All right. We'll do that in just a couple of minutes with Clifford Carnicum. Okay, and we continue with Clifford, and don't forget his website has all of these articles right there on the homepage. Go right ahead, please, Clifford.
Thanks, Jeff. I'll try to watch my time. I know what you're up against, and I'll try to work with it best I can. But, you know, the result of this study here that we're talking about, where a child offered their blood for examination, at least for observation, I guess.
Sure.
Is that age does not appear to be a factor here of exclusion, basically. The situation that's being observed is transcending different age groups, anywhere from 9 years old to, you know, 68 years old, something like that. And that now opens up the box even a little bit wider as to how serious this situation might be. And it was at this time, you know, I spent a great deal of time, I'll just say, this was probably, I don't know, 2 to 3 weeks, just solid study, you know, in my books, my pathology books and such, to try and find out what is this organism, what could this organism be. And in my case, often I have to work through a process of exclusion. You know, I don't have access to direct identification, so I often usually have to work by indirect means and exclude one thing after another, and it's a very slow process when you're going through all the books that way. But I spent quite a bit of time on this to try to find out what kind of organism, what kind of structure, if it is something conventional, what would match what it is I'm seeing. And at the end of this work, I have come to an assessment. Again, there's nothing conclusive about it in the slightest bit, but yes, I do offer it. I would say, hey, those folks with the proper resources, this is one candidate for you to consider. And I want to go through the list very quickly as to what it is that I came up with that would cause me to at least seriously question the existence of chlamydia pneumonia-like. Here they are. The organism involved must measure on the order of submicron, generally on the order of 0.5 to 0.7 microns. And what it means is every one of these things I'm listing, I'm having a match for, and that's why I offer it as a candidate.
Okay.
That is where chlamydia pneumonia will be. Lowest it'll be is 0.3 up to about a micron. So the size range that I'm getting at is right in there. Size is extremely important. It's certainly one of the first key mechanisms that we can use to at least, certainly you can exclude many, many things from it, if not identify what something is alone. Second, the organism is an intracellular organism and can exist within human red blood cells, erythrocytes. This is pretty profound in terms of that characteristic. This is a, you know, normal bacteria. They're not inside the cells. This is not a common thing. This is a very serious issue when you have a bacterial form, if indeed that's what it is, that occurs within the cell. Much harder to identify, isolate, see to begin with. I mean, the amount of work it took to see these things was very extended, and I have serious questions or doubts as to whether any conventional testing procedure would even approach this problem. By the way, I will mention this. After I came up with this assessment, it was after the fact, but I did a search on has there been any association or identification of chlamydia pneumonia with the Morgellons condition, and I found actually some pretty strong references that were saying that, yes, it looks like this particular condition is being identified amongst many people. Again, I do not point to anything absolute here. I just offer the leads. But that's a rather major and profound characteristic of this structure that is occurring within the cells. And by the way, at this point, I'll go ahead and mention there is a website. I'm just saying chlamydia pneumonia is something worthy of looking at. Take a look at it. And there's a website called CPN Help, as in Charlie Papa November, cpnhelp.org. That website is devoted towards individuals that realize the seriousness and significance of chlamydia pneumonia and how it manifests. And there's a photograph. If people look closely on that, there's a photograph on that front. I think it's on their front page. Did they pull it from there? It's in their site. Yeah, it's on the front page. It's on the front page. And this was a key turning point for me because they show photographs, and I have to say I have a match the best I can. They show these within erythrocytes, within red blood cells. They have a dark field microscope photograph there, microphotograph of chlamydia pneumonia. And all I can say is we have a match in terms of what's happening there. This stuff occurs within erythrocytes or red blood cells. The people can look at the conditions, the illness conditions that are associated with chlamydia pneumonia. Examples would be multiple sclerosis, chronic fatigue, cardiac disease, arthritis, asthma, fibromyalgia, macular degeneration. You know, people can do their own look at that, but that site would be worthy of looking at, I think,
yeah,
for people.
Pretty difficult to, in a quick diagnosis, tell the difference between other kinds of pneumonia and chlamydia pneumonia, though there's a pretty definite overlay in generalities in terms of manifestations. Cough,
exactly,
fever,
yeah, crossing many,
breathing.
Many lines. And that's a lot of what that website talks about, is how difficult it is for these people to get support or assistance from the medical community in terms of getting this thing identified. To follow through with that list, the next one, if I can find it. Yeah, here we go. The organism is likely to be associated with respiratory conditions and is circulated by aerosol means. If you look up on chlamydia pneumonia, that is how it's circulated, is in the air, and it is associated with respiratory illnesses. The organism is spherical to oblate, but can exist in more than one form, pleomorphic. We start looking at these ribbon structures and this type of thing, and I have questions about whether or not we have some transformations of form taking place. And the next one would be a Gram stain produces a negative result. That's a certain type of staining something that shows up certain types of bacterial forms. Basically, I have eight conditions here. And they're matching the best I can, at least from my level, with very strong consideration of this as one component, again, one component of what we may be dealing with.
Interesting. Yeah, very interesting. Doxycycline, of course, a primary agent to treat chlamydia pneumonia. Some Morgellons patients have reportedly had marginal relief for a certain period of time with heavy doses of doxycycline, but nothing that can be called a complete cure. All right, be right back in a minute. right, let's get back to our conversation with Clifford Connicom. And we are all ears, Clifford. Go right ahead, please.
Thank you a lot, Jeff. The next three papers I'm just going to make mention of. I won't go over them.
They're on Clifford's homepage, too, all right?
Because I know we're going to run out of time as usual, but we've done a great job, I think, trying to get through this. And there's three papers, and these are going on through the month of January, and they go through March, and they get us through the end of March. So January through March. And basically, the papers are, one of them will be called Morgellons 5th, 6th, and 7th match. The next one will be called Pathogens in the General Population. And the last one is that red wine and or peroxide, or actually grape juice, or organic grape juice. All three of these seem to be helpful. That's the title of the paper. What I'm going to do is just summarize what these papers are about. And these papers are important in the sense that they represent a consolidation of all that we have been talking about and building up to, you know, over the last couple hours. You know, Leeuwenhoek, if I pronounce his name correctly, apparently this guy, you know, he's probably like me in some ways. You know, he's the guy behind the original microscope. And this guy apparently, when he got under the scope, you know, he was discovering things for the first time. But he would see something, and he's the first person ever seeing it in the history of modern mankind,
first
at least.
First man to look into the inner world.
And he sees these things, and it's like he does it over and over and over and over, because he has this thing about wanting to convince himself, I guess, that this is what he's actually seeing. So he does these things just hundreds of times because he wants to be absolutely confident of what he's doing. In some ways, I feel like that because, you know, I try not to rush anything here. And this period that I'm talking about now, from January through March, represents a time period where, you know, I'm under the scope over and over and over to see whether or not, no matter where I go with the samples, am I seeing the same things over and over? And the answer is yes, and it takes a great deal of time to get there, but these papers are summarizing what it is that you and I have been talking about, and that is, you know, this work is at the point where there are four or five, depending how we want to go about it, I would say five at this point, five basic physical forms that are being seen over and over and over, independent of whether somebody is manifesting a skin condition or not. These forms are crossing all major body systems,
mm-hmm.
you know, digestive, mm-hmm. urinary, blood, hair, dental, crossing all major system functions of the body across the board, whether somebody is manifesting a so-called skin condition or not. The name Morgellons is something that I truly have to qualify because it's been basically put into a little box and category and just not appear to encompass the scope of the situation that we're talking about. So that's the result of that work, and that's what I offer as a base or a starting point. And I've made the point before, and I'll make it again, and that is it's not okay with me to say I'm seeing this over and over and over, I'm taking the photographs over and over and over, I'm telling you over and over and over what they are, and we go on and we go on and we go on, and we do not have that stuff immediately, not a matter of planning a year or two down the road, but immediately under the highest quality equipment that's available to all of mankind, immediate positive identification of what it is, and if it doesn't fit in a normal scope and we don't have positive identification, then you allow for something new that we need to learn about.
Mm-hmm.
But to not have this done, you know, I won't let it go, just as I will not let the EPA go until this job is done, none of us are off the hook. And that's my call, and it will be continue to be my call until it's done. And I suspect if I keep up the rant long enough, we're going to get it done. And it may be done in different means than things are done normally. So what I wanted to go on to next was, and this is a topic I haven't written up. There's a couple things I'd like to probably finish our conversation with. One will be sort of another example of how the research links in to the past many times years ago that we don't understand at the time how significant that it may be or what importance it is. And then hopefully we can also get some couple of unusual photographs in by the end of the night that we missed last time.
Right.
But I'd like to go on to a topic, and this one, this is a case where this is just, let's say, circulating in my head. This is something I haven't written up yet. But there are some interesting things going on in terms of connections. And I have to recount some history here, and I'll take a little bit of time with this, probably the majority of what we have left beside that photograph. But it has to do with proteins. And here's what happens. If we go back to the earliest work, when the fibrous samples, environmental fibrous airborne samples, are presented to me, and I start putting them under the scope with my little 30 power or 100 power toy microscope and my strapped on camera.
Mm-hmm.
And what do? I start subjecting these fibers to all types of analysis. Straightforward, common sense science. Nothing real special, but something that anybody could do if they wanted to. But a lot of observations, beginning of measurements. I start learning about fibers in general. I become pretty decent at identifying most type of fibers. Go through all the natural and synthetic fibers.
Right.
Get down the sizes.
There are a lot of them.
This stuff. And this stuff was done in 1999. And the photographs, it's sort of funny to see them, you know, because they're circular, you know, as you get the vignetting looking through the microscope there. I'm pretty primitive. But they do show you the original form of what we saw going on. Well, there were some chemical tests that those things were subjected to, and I would basically try different solutions, different reagents, just to see if I could get a reaction. What happens to these things?
Mm-hmm.
And this goes across the board to all these fibers, as well as the EPA fiber. Well, if you look at this, again, it's not really stated with any kind of exclamation, but I was after a reaction. That was my goal. I don't care what the reaction is. I just want to see if I can get a reaction. And if you look at these photographs, you're going to see something that's a little different, and that is that when that fiber sample was subjected to a hair perm solution, there is a reaction, a significant one, and it does seriously degrade, we could say not quite dissolve, but seriously damage the structure of that filament. It turns sort of into a gel-like structure. It's obviously breaking it down, and it's the only solution that I found that had that type of impact upon those fibers. Now, the question starts to come up, what the heck are you doing using hair perm solution, and why?
All right, we'll find out in just a minute. This is amazing research, and I would urge all of you to go to Clifford's site and avail yourself of it. There's a lot to come. You get the idea that the entire Morgellons community is not focused in one area, and it needs to really do something to get its act together. There are a lot of disparate portions and pieces of it that are going off in strange and unusual trajectories, and somehow we've got to bring people back toward a singular focus, or at least one that approaches or approximates that. We'll be back in just a minute. Okay, we return in our last segment already with Clifford. All right, Clifford. Great.
Thanks, Jeff. I'm going to try to tie this together. I may not make it, but I'm going to try.
This would be a good jump. I want to hear this.
Now, the folks that would like to make fun of the hair perm approach, I'm going to throw out three terms for you to play with. I hope I get the first one pronounced properly. But the first one is ammonium thioglycolate. This is a chemical compound. Dig into these three things and start forming some questions and links. The second one will be disulfide bonds, bonds of sulfur. And the third will be keratin, protein form.
Right.
I'm going to throw out those three terms, and you can play with those instead of having fun with the hair perm game. And there are some questions and things that we're going to be looking at over time that look very, very interesting. Now, why was I interested in this hair perm solution. It's because it reacts to proteins. Now, why was I interested in proteins? Most people don't know this because I've never taken the time to go over it properly, but there was a lab test done. Good money was paid for it. Good money was paid for a private lab to analyze these fibers that the EPA refused to identify. Mm-hmm. I received that lab report back. That lab report is false. The results of that lab report are false.
Really?
It's another whole story, and we have time. I'll go into it. But basically, the people come back, and they start saying, it's actually very interesting. It gets subjective. They actually have two reports within one, and one of them says, you know, this looks like wool or silk, and the other one says it's like. They don't say, you know, when you send something to a lab, you want to know what it is, not what it might be. And in both cases, they come back and they say it's sort of like wool or silk, and the other one, it's sort of like spider's web. Well, that's false, and there's another whole story to that. I actually went to that lab and confronted that CEO directly with my own work, and I had 9 reasons to show that person why I knew that these were not spider webs or any kind of traditional fiber of any kind. We may have made mention to that, but basically I had 9 things to go through. I made it through number 2, and the CEO told me this meeting is over and terminated our conversation.
Uh-huh.
I made it through number 1 of the list of 9. The results of that lab were incorrect and false. Now, what is interesting, though, is that on that lab report, there is a reference to the existence of proteins, a protein, let's say, component or aspect to the fibers. So in my work, to test things, I wanted to find out, all right, how do I learn if something is protein-based or not, regardless of what it is? And you'll find that particular chemical, that ammonium thioglycolate that's in hair perm solutions, is, let's say, very important for breaking down sulfur bonds that are characteristic of keratin protein forms that are present in our hair. Now, why is this all important? Number one, you have initial chemical tests that show a reaction to the environmental sample, unlike anything else, where it does destroy the internal structure of those fibers. Number two, you have a lab report, which at least gives an indication that there may be a protein component involved, but let's say disguises the true objective of that lab identification, whether with intent or not is probably never known.
Mm-hmm.
What's important now to me is that I revisited the subject again, and these dental fibers that you and I have been speaking of tonight,
yes,
I have subjected those to this same chemical solution, and it basically obliterates them. And there's not many things that seem to do that, by the way, but this chemical breaks down those fibers in a radical way. Now, what does it mean? What it means is that there is a significant basis, again, for investigation of a significant component of these fibers, no matter in whatever form they're occurring, whether they came from the air, whether they came from the skin, whether they came from inside the teeth, as having a proteinaceous component to them, specifically keratin. Now, if you look at a paper I wrote about 2 months ago, I made a little reference on there, and I said, fungal forms, how do you test if something is a fungal form? And you'll see that I found a DOD paper for biological warfare stuff where they develop a method for the testing of keratin within a fungus. In other words, one of the identifying characteristics of a fungal form is the existence of keratin. And here is a link that I just came up with last night. I didn't exactly know this, but why is keratin? Is it just a part of fungus? No. The answer is that fungal forms commonly feed, they live, they thrive on keratin. Okay. Now, why is this important? Because keratin is in our skin. Keratin is in everything about our scalp, our skin. Something like this one paper saying 80% of the outside layer of our skin is keratin-based. All right? There is now, for the first time on my side, it's been claimed many times, but I have no basis for it up until now, there is a significant lead in terms of the investigation of, indeed, whether there is a fungal aspect to this fibrous form. There is no match to species that can be made. It's clearly not normal. I'll say that. I can find no match at all where you have any kind of encasing filament of a submicron network. But in terms of the chemical reaction that's taken place and the fact that fungal forms feed on keratin and can be used as a means of identification of fungal forms, and when you start looking at where these forms are manifesting in the skin and the hair, and get this is one I was after. I was saying if this idea is right, and at this point it's just a hypothesis, but there is a serious issue involving teeth here. We haven't had time to talk about it, but there's been a significant degradation of teeth that's taking place with this. And one of the first questions I had to ask is, this hypothesis has any basis to it all, shouldn't it be that teeth also would have keratin in them? And I didn't know the answer to this, but I looked up, and sure enough, they do. The enamel of teeth contains keratin. So basically, you have a basis for saying, why are these things manifesting, and what is it that is actually feeding them? And all I'm doing is I'm suggesting that we may have a basis of sustenance or nourishment of a fungal form, not conventional or classical by any means, doesn't fall into regular books, but would feed off the very environment that we find it in, namely teeth, hair, and skin. Again, and what's unique here, too, is those fibrous forms, filament forms, are not within the blood. That's where the chlamydia-like stuff is showing up the most. Okay, so we are talking about this filament form manifesting in the exterior of the body, more so, as well as teeth. So I offer it as a lead, a very interesting lead of investigation, and I'll have to leave it at that. And I know we're running out of time, and this is completely off the subject, but it should be mentioned, because it just needs to be, we need to be made aware of it. And that is, I have a couple photographs that somebody sent me about a month or two ago. Mm-hmm. And the title of that paper is called Aerosol Anomalies. And it is pretty amazing. I've never seen anything like it in my life, that's for sure. But if you call up that paper, and I can't actually find it right at this moment, but you have a very high-quality image of a most unusual ring-like structure in the sky. The photograph is very clear, and there's two of them there. You literally have this ring that shows up in the sky. And what's really unique about this is you have a darn emission trail coming from it. I don't know what to make of this yet, but it raises all kinds of interesting questions about why is there this emission trail? What is going on here? Okay, but this is not anything conventional. Let's just say that. And people can look at those photographs and start asking some questions about why would you have and by the way, these objects were identified, were observed, were recorded in the midst of significant aerosol operations, okay, where we have water planes or appear to be planes. There's a lot of mysteries about all that stuff that can go on. But this clearly does not fit in the normal expectation or genre of what we're talking about when people are starting to talk about emissions of any kind and or any kind of structure in the sky. So, you know, I wanted people to be aware of those photographs and start now asking some other questions about what are we really dealing with here.
Well said. We've got just about 2 minutes left. I see so much to talk about here. Now, we also have the research that Jan Smith has done with these fibers that are observable at 30, 40, 50, 60 power, in which they can withstand literally a butane torch up to around 1,300 degrees. They're tough as nails. Now, these fibers are not the same fibrous masses that are coming out of the mouths after the swishing around of red wine. They're different. Or are you suggesting, Clifford, that they are the same in a matrix form of some kind?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that, and I don't know until we get examination down at the, you know, the microscopic or molecular level what it is we're dealing with. Because, I have been, surprised many times that I don't even begin to know what's going on until I start to see this stuff at this extremely high magnification. We need good equipment. We need the proper tools to do this.
We do.
And I don't know the answer to that. I will also, yes, it does get complicated. You're right. We could go on for a long time because, you know, there are two other forms that I have seen, and I know some of these reports, and I put that stuff, you know, subject to a flame, that very early work in 99. That's one of the first things I did was subject
to a
flame.
Yeah, I think I remember that. We talked about it way back when, yeah.
And I am only one person, and I don't have access to all the resources. I can simply offer this vantage point as a basis for people calling together the resources to get this job done right.
Absolutely right. They've got to be compared, absolutely taken apart. There are suggestions that the so-called normal Morgellons fibers upon high magnification show internal fibers in vast numbers. This is fascinating. And for you to have found, in your limited research, the same markers in 100% of the people is...
It is, and that's why can't be ignored. I mean, you take care of basics first, and then you can consider tangents and exotic things when you need to.
It's true. Clifford, I thank you, and I always, as usual, salute you. Thank you, my friend, for everything, and we'll be here to help you.
Jeff, thank you very much in return and for allowing me the freedom and time to discuss this.
Always. All right, we'll talk soon. Take care. Clifford Carnicom. Wow. Morgellons. What is it? Well, we're going to find out someday. Be back.